This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hi, this is John with a quick word from our sponsor. JetBrains, the guys who made ReSharper, extend their toolset for .NET developers. If you're doing .NET and you're looking for a good unit test coverage tool that supports .NET apps and Silverlight, try .cover. It highlights coverage right in Visual Studio and integrates nicely with ReSharper's unit testing tools. Get a 30-day trial and a sweet introductory price at jetbrains.com/.cover.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Herding Code. This is being recorded on January 19th, 2011. And today we are talking to Rob Eisenberg about his Caliburn Micro project. Thanks for coming on, Rob.
Thank you for having me.
Longtime listeners may remember Rob from one of our early podcast episodes about presentation patterns. So welcome back.
Thank you.
So I had this idea for this show because I've started using Caliburn Micro and I've been super impressed with it. It does some very cool things that I haven't seen other libraries do. So generally, it falls into this bucket of MVVM frameworks, but it does a lot more than that. So why don't you give your elevator pitch on what Caliburn Micro is?
That's a pretty good start, actually. It falls into that MVVM framework bucket, but it does do quite a bit more. It's an opinionated framework, I would say, which is probably unique among the things that are out there for doing MVVM. A couple of the major feature areas that make it unique are something we call actions, which are very much akin to what you would see in something like ASP.NET MVC, or they're originally actually inspired by Monorail. So this is just a way of mapping user interactions through to methods, more or less. Instead of them living on a controller, they live on a view model. And there's a host of features around actions that make them really nice to use. The second kind of big feature area we have that I think people recognize is support for conventions. And we have a host of conventions for mapping actions, for doing data binding, for connecting views and view models together, various things like that. Just trying to get rid of sort of the tedious code of connecting things. And then the third area, I would say, is that we have a series of classes that implement various presentation roles. And these kind of fall in around some of Jeremy Miller's screens and conductors ideas. And these are really, you can think of them as a set of Legos that you can sort of pop together in different ways to build your application's shell or to build complex screens within that shell. Those are the big areas. And then we also have some other typical kind of utility things. We have event aggregation, and we have some stuff around window management, your typical base class for doing property change notification and things like that. That's the high-level nutshell.
So now you also have a framework called Caliburn. Can you what's the difference there? Can you compare and contrast?
Sure. Caliburn was around first. I started as something I was playing around with probably late 2006, and I first showed it around 2007, and it was just evolving. It just evolved out of some of our early WPF work building line of business apps, and it was really built for WPF, built for larger applications. It had a traditional model around extensibility that you might find in framework. It was it's basically a series of probably a couple dozen interfaces that are hooked together by IOC and do a bunch of the stuff that I just talked about. But there's a lot more features. It handles a lot more edge cases. It was a lot bigger and more complex because it was built for WPF, and frankly, because I built it earlier, and my ideas were, let's just say, perhaps not as refined as they are several years later. And so basically what happened was last year I did a talk at Mix called Build Your Own MVVM Framework. And what I did was I tried to take some of the ideas from Caliburn and show them in a small simplified framework. Because I felt the ideas were really neat, but I was noticing that people seemed to be kind of scared to pick up Caliburn, I think because of its size and complexity. But that talk got a really, really good reception. And so I was encouraged by several companies to consider, you know, perhaps making a smaller version of Caliburn, and that became Caliburn Micro. And what I basically tried to do is take what I considered to be the most important features from Caliburn and the most important use cases and try and come up with the simplest implementation that would work in real applications. And so Calibre Micro kind of came out of that, and that's really the relationship there. I think that probably Calibre Micro will do just about what anyone needs to do on a normal project. And it's smaller and simpler, so if you need to get in there and add a feature, it's much, much easier than it would be in Calibre. But that's kind of the relationship between the two. And Calibre Micro doesn't have some of the baggage that Calibre had from being built before various features were added to Silverlight and WPF and before various changes in the way people were doing things with behaviors and Silverlight came about. So it's a little bit more modern, I would say, in its implementation of some of those things.
So what's the upsizing story? Let's say I'm working with Calibre Micro and I hit an edge case where I need Calibre, you know, like the full pro ultimate enterprise version. is that like relatively seamless to move between those?
Yeah, it should be. I actually haven't been going in that direction myself. I've been moving things in the opposite direction from the big framework to the small framework. But what I've tried to do is keep the APIs pretty much the same, especially the APIs that the average developer would use. Now, some of the extensibility mechanisms between the two are different, and that's where you would have to write a little bit more custom code. But your usage of actions, the API is pretty much the same there. There's just a few more features in Calibre. All the screens and conductor pieces I talked about, the implementation of those is identical, actually, between the two frameworks. I wanted those two to be exactly the same. So if you're building view models based on them, there's actually no code change that would occur moving from one to the other. Conventions are implemented entirely different under the covers of the two, but the conventions themselves are the same. And there's a little bit more smarts in the convention in Calibre. So I think if you were moving from the small version to the larger version, it should be pretty easy. I've actually been doing more moving things the opposite direction, which hasn't been too hard either.
So is Calibre sort of done at this point? I mean, is Calibre Micro the follow-up?
Well, I'm working on a version 2.0 of Calibre, and it's likely that will be the last major version of that. I might be doing a point release or something like that. Calibre Micro is certainly what I'm using on all of my projects. It's funny because it's extensible, but in an entirely unorthodox way. Most of its internal services are not implemented in your typical, I have an interface and then I have a default implementation, and if you want to change it, you re-implement the interface. That's sort of the way Calibre works, but Micro basically is a little bit almost inspired by JavaScript in a way that it has static classes with all of its important methods implemented as fields. So you can literally replace individual methods internally and change their implementations. And I found out that at least with my own self, I was actually more likely to customize things on a per-app basis because it was just easier. And you could get to exactly the piece you wanted a little bit easier to customize. So while 2.0 is still kicking, I think Calibre Micro is a little bit simpler, a little bit easier to customize the way you want to. It doesn't have some of the baggage of being built originally against .NET 3. So there probably will be a version 2.0 of Calibre Micro, but the present version that's soon to be released of Calibre will probably be the last major version. And I'm trying to encourage people to kind of move from one to the other as they can. I'll keep supporting it, of course, and do bug fixes, but probably not going to do any major things with it. All my new ideas will be going probably into Calibre Micro.
So you were saying that the way of implementing something is, you know, it's different because everything's implemented as funks. So, at the risk of trying to talk about code on a podcast, which is always fun, let's say, can you give a more concrete example of that? Like, let's say I want to override something about how Calibre Micro works. How do I go about doing that?
So one of the most common things that people like to customize is how we pair a view with a view model. So our typical implementation the standard implementation is very, very simple. We look at your view model type and we literally just cut the word model out of the full type name. And then we look for a type with that new name and we find it, we instantiate it and return it. So if you have like customer view model, then we find customer view. We figure that's a reasonable convention and we put them together. But that doesn't work for everyone's scenario. So if you wanted to change that behavior, there's literally a static class called viewLocator, and it has a public static func field called locateForModel or something like that. There's a few different ones you can And basically what you would do is you just set that field equal to your own lambda expression that takes a type in and spits a type back out. And you've now just added your own mapping between view models and views. With Caliburn, you would have to basically get the iView locator interface and either implement the whole thing or inherit from the base class, override the right methods, and then go to the configuration and plug it into the ILC container manually or through the configuration API. So there's a lot more steps. And you, when you do that, most people are going to inherit from the default implementation, even if they're not using a lot of what's there. So that carries the baggage with it as well. This ended up being a lot simpler in the end, though. The reason I actually did it was because I was trying to find how I could actually make the code size as small as possible. And I found that if I didn't have all these additional interfaces and I didn't have some kind of an IOC and configuration abstraction, which I would need to make the thing configurable, and I just used the sort of, it's a little bit more like how you might change methods on a JavaScript object. If I used this technique, it actually made things a lot smaller. And I really wanted it for Silverlight apps, and especially for Windows Phone 7 apps, I wanted things to be as small as possible. So that's why I decided to do that. But in the end, it actually, I found that I liked it. At least for this framework in this scenario, I found that I liked it a lot more for customizing things. It's very unorthodox, though. I know some people take some pretty serious issues with doing things that way, but that's also kind of ivory tower, in my opinion, for this specific scenario.
I guess that's one of the benefits of having an opinionated framework, is you get to do that kind of thing.
Exactly.
So, but I mean, generally, has response been good? It sounds really cool. I mean, it sounds like you're able to override at a very specific level.
So far, there's been a couple people that didn't like it, but most people haven't complained. And even those that don't like it, I've actually submitted some ideas about how that idea could be expanded just a little bit more to do things like prevent overriding after certain points, sort of freezing method implementations and things like that. But overall, I think it works pretty well. There's a couple other extensibility mechanisms that are a little bit different, but that's the main way that a lot of the services of the framework itself are actually altered in their behavior.
So you mentioned view model location / view location, which is an interesting feature of the framework because it's designed to support both view model first and view first style development. Maybe you can mention a little bit about that.
Sure. Those are the two main sort of ways that people tend to mentally approach designing a solution with NVVM. Either the view model first, which is where you're thinking of and conceiving in your mind of the view model, and the framework sort of starts by creating the view model and then finding the view. And so the view model is sort of in control of things, versus the view first, where you sort of think about the first, or at least the view is created first, and then we go out and locate a view model, and then we bind them together. So the view is a little bit more controlling of things. The preferred way in Caliburn Micro is view model first, although I do support both, and in a lot of applications, there's likely to be a bit of a mixture of the two. I prefer view model first because that gives the developer, I think, a little bit more control over how things are being instantiated, and I like my view models to be pretty much POCO classes, very testable, and to drive the views through their state changes. Things get a little bit muddy sometimes when the view comes first, particularly in complex scenarios where people are trying to figure out how to do like a navigation application or an MDI style application. These things, if you start thinking from a view first and you start by creating the views first and then trying to deal with the sort of interesting semantics around deactivation of tabs or closing out edit windows and things like this, it gets very, very, very complicated from that angle. But if you simply shift your perspective thinking of the view model first and having that drive the views, those problems end up greatly simplifying, I think. So the framework supports both those ways so that you can sort of pick whichever one makes sense for the given feature set that you're working on. But the mentality, I think, that's really ingrained the most in the framework itself is a view model first approach. To the extent that, for example, if you're writing a WPF application, you don't ever new up a main window. Your bootstrapper, you just tell it what your view model is that sort of represents your application's shell. Then the framework goes out and locates a view for that model, and if it's a window, it shows the window, and if not, we create a window for you and sort of hook everything up and show it. So it's very much in thinking of models and the model of the user interface. Everything is just sort of about view models and state changes and thinking in those terms. It's very much around letting the data binding sort of take over, synchronizing what the thing looks like based off of the construction and composition and state changes of your view models. So in that case, starting with the view model first simplifies things, and that's sort of the idea behind this framework. That's one of the opinions, though we give you that way out if you need to start with the view.
One of the things people talk about when they talk about WPF and Silverlight apps is blendability of the UI, you know, the ability to style the UI in Expression Blend. Are there implications for blendability with Caliburn Micro, or does it all just kind of work?
There are some implications. It mostly relates to using the binding conventions. So we have different kinds of conventions. We have the conventions I described earlier around view model and view pairing, which can work fine with Blend using the traditional Blend techniques for setting up design time, data context, and things like that. We have conventions around actions, which compare user interactions to view model methods. That really doesn't have anything to do with Blend at all. But the third one are data binding conventions. Because Blend itself doesn't understand those, if you have some sample data, it's not going to show that sample data because the bindings, in effect, do not exist at design time. They exist at runtime. There's a couple of ways around this, if you need to find a way around it. One is, say you have a text box that's bound to a text to a field on a view model by convention, and you want to see what that text box looks like with data in it inside of Blend. Well, you can actually just set the text property in Blend, and at runtime we'll overwrite that with the convention binding. So you can still see the design time data, if you will, in actually a simpler way than using Blend's design time data mechanism, because you're just setting the property like you normally would on the control, and then we'll overwrite that with the binding convention later on. It's also possible, I haven't done this, and I would love a community contribution in this area, but it's quite possible Blend is extensible now, to write a plugin that would look at the view and use Caliburn Micro's conventions to apply those bindings at design time. There's not enough hours in the day for me to do that right now, but I'm pretty darn sure that that is quite possible with Blend. Now, these things don't matter if you're a very developer-centric shop or if you're building a lot of line-of-business apps and you're just going to drop in some prefab themes. A lot of people don't work with Blend and don't care, so it really doesn't apply in that scenario. If you're a very design-centric shop, you're probably going to care a lot about it. In that case, you may not use those binding conventions. And you can turn conventions off at the framework level or on a view-by-view basis. So it's going to really depend on your team and the type of apps that you're building, how much you'll be affected by that. It may be that a screen is developed first by a developer that puts together a basic mock UI and then hands it over to a designer later. Well, he may take advantage of conventions to get things up and running on his end, but when the designer comes in, they're not going to harm anything by adding the explicit data bindings that they want for design time, because we never override a data binding expression with the convention if there's one there. So if that's your workflow, you can do it that way. So there's a lot of different angles you can sort of approach it. I haven't seen a lot of serious complaints about it, because you can always put the binding expressions in yourself and just choose not to use that particular feature. I'd love a community contribution in that area, because I think that would be extremely compelling to see conventions applied inside at design time in Blend, but I haven't written it yet, and no one else has. So
let's talk a little bit more about the convention-based binding, because that was one of the features that really kind of wowed me when I started using the framework. What kinds of conventions do you guys use, and how are they applied?
So most conventions start with a basic naming pattern. I described the view and the view model pattern. That's very, very simple. But once we have your view and your view model and we bind them together, we then do a little bit of reflection on your view model to see what properties it has. And we look at the named controls on your view. And if we find a name match between the two, so for example, a text box in your view called first name and a property in your view model called first name, we make the assumption that you want to data bind those together. So we generate a data binding expression. We'll do things. We'll try and be smart about it. We'll look at your property to see if it has a getter and a setter. And if it has both, then we'll assume you want two-way data binding. We'll look to see if your view model implements the iDataError.info interface. And if so, then we'll assume that you want to turn validation on for that particular binding. We also pump it through a small pipeline where we can optionally apply automatic value conversion. We only have one convention for that out of the box, which is a standard convention for mapping Boolean values to visibility. So if we see that you have a visibility property in your view and a Boolean property in your view model, we'll automatically put the converter in there to hook that up. So we try and be kind of smart about the details of the binding. Like I said, we never overwrite a binding if you have one. So we do name matching. We try and be smart about the properties that we set on the binding expression, and then for every element that we do the name match on, we have a set of conventions around that GUI element. So we look up text boxes convention, and we see that we actually should add the binding to the text property. That seems like a reasonable default, so that's what the framework does out of the box. So we add the binding to the text property. So every element, every main usage element, I would say, has conventions set up around what property should be data bound to it, and it can actually, on an element-by-element basis, using some of the funk techniques that I talked about before, you can override on an element-by-element basis how conventions are applied. They're mostly pretty simple, though, like I stated. We've got a few kind of smarter conventions that help in doing composition. So, for example, the content controls convention is not to data bind against the content property, but to data bind using a special attached property we define called ViewModel. And what this attached property allows us to do is to compose in a subview for the property that's being bound to. So very simply, we can create fine-grained view models that are composed together. And because we have these convention bindings and the special one with the content control and a similar one with items control, we can basically render a similar hierarchy of views over top of the same hierarchy of your view models. And it all sort of gets composed in together automatically at runtime. So we've got some conventions that are around composition like that that just make it really easy to do modular application development and complex shells and complex screens. Aside from the binding conventions, we have the action conventions as well, and they work very much the same way. So for example, if you have a button with a name of save, and then you have a method on your view model called save, we'll assume that you want the button to trigger the invocation of that method. So we'll go ahead and wire that up. And that gets wired up to our action system that has some additional features around how we invoke that method, such as coroutines, which is something that a lot of people like as well. But those are the conventions in a nutshell. I should mention there's a lot of documentation I've been trying to write on all this stuff on the Coplex site, which is caliburnmicro.coplex.com. And all the conventions are pretty extensively documented now. There's an article there that talks about everything that I basically just described and walks you through the workflow of what the engine is doing under the cover so you can see how those things are playing out at runtime, and shows various extensibility points for adding your own conventions or changing the conventions that are there. Related to that, anytime you get into conventions, things start to feel magical. For me, it's very natural because obviously I built the framework and I've been doing things this way for some time. But it's not that way for everybody, especially people getting started. One of the things that we have is a simple logging abstraction in the framework. And everything that happens in the convention system gets piped through this logging system. So you can throw like a debug logger in there and basically watch every match that we're finding for conventions and every match we're bypassing. So you can see everything that's happening there if you get some kind of strange behavior or you're not sure why something isn't showing up or what have you. Something I learned from Jeremy Miller, he told me that anytime that you get into conventions, you should have some sort of diagnostic mechanism. So that is in there so you can see what's happening.
And in fact, Jeremy asked that exact question on Twitter right before this podcast. So
yeah, I actually saw that. So I thought I'd go ahead and toss in the answer. But yeah, that's important, actually, and I'm not sure that everybody knows about that being there, but it's really, really simple. I've got a sample now, too, that actually has a logger plugged in, so you can watch the sample as you play around with it. You can watch everything that the framework is doing. You can see when every action is invoked. You can see when conventions are applied, when views are located, all that kind of stuff. If we can't find a view, we do things like pop in a dummy view into your UI that says, we tried to find this, but couldn't find it. So we try and kind of help you out with those scenarios.
I think that's really cool. Like, you know, everyone loves convention-based configurations, but it does get frustrating when you're working with one and then something doesn't work and you're just screwed because all of a sudden it doesn't work and it's really hard to know why. And you know what I mean? And especially there's no error message. There's no anything to find that out. So that sounds like a really cool way to kind of handle that to, you know, to make something that's going to do the best thing by default. But then if you get stuck, you can figure out why it didn't do what you expected.
I think Jeremy, when he mentioned that to me sometime back, was speaking from probably a painful past experience. So I didn't want to repeat that in my own world or inflict that upon my users if I could help it.
Right, right. Yeah, I see that, you know, writing tutorials and stuff for beginners is like people, you know, I'll say, this is great. This is a convention. Here's how to use it. This is neat. And then someone will misspell a word. And it's, you know, it's just a misspelling. Yep. It's something tiny. And then all of a sudden the app doesn't work. And they have no idea what's wrong and no idea how to troubleshoot it. And so I think that kind of getting that transition from, you know, like a magical thing that works with no work to it's something that, you know, when the magic goes bad to figuring out why it's not working, it, you know, that's a great transition. So that sounds like a good way to handle that.
Right. And that's also a little bit of a lesson learned from WPF because the same problem exists actually if you're writing your binding expression straight out, because that's all sort of a late bound type of thing. And if you misspell there, you'll never know what's happening. Now, they have some debug stuff you can turn on now and get the same kind of information as well. So it kind of follows that same pattern. Yeah, because, you know, when we were doing WPF development early on, we would just get into scenarios where writing a line of business app, for example, you were filling out a form with some data and you would look in the database and not all the data would be there. And you start making some assumption that, oh, is there something wrong with the data access layer? Is there something wrong with my entities? And it turned out that, you know, you misspelled first name in the data binding expression. And so the data was never actually being synchronized back into the model. That's been a pain point really since the beginning. So when I went to implement conventions as well, there had to be some way of exposing information about what was happening so that if you did have a scenario like that, you could find it, you know, find it pretty quickly, or at least get access to the information that you could use to investigate the situation.
Are there places where you wanted to do more sophisticated, you know, convention stuff, but the framework wouldn't let you? Like, were there places where you could, you know, you didn't have the right hooks into Silverlight or WPF to do some super cool stuff that you wanted to do?
Yeah, more or less, the data template mechanism is a bit of a pain. We can't right now automatically apply conventions inside of data templates because the framework itself, it controls the instantiation of the UI from the template, so there's no real way for us to intercept that, inspect what was generated by the template, and apply conventions to it. So you have to add an attach property inside of your data template in order for us to sort of hook into that. I would have liked to not have to do that, but there's no way around that. And in fact, fixing that problem, for example, if data templates, whatever the method is, create template, or I forget what the method is that actually generates the UI, if that was virtual and the class wasn't sealed, then I could actually just create my own implementation of data template, and I could literally do all the composition that we do through custom attached properties and everything through that one mechanism, and I could conventionally set that data template on any template-based control that didn't have a template, and I could do all kinds of things a little bit smoother and without having to create intermediary elements and add additional attached properties. So that's one place. That's definitely a limitation, though, you know, we've been able to get pretty far without that. I actually mentioned that to the Silverlight team, and they looked at me funny, like, why would you ever want to do that? But then again, at the time, they didn't really understand the notion of why of conventions either. So, but hopefully maybe a little bit more awareness now. But yeah, that's a point of extensibility that would be nice. When it comes to Windows Phone 7, there are a lot of points where the platform right now is extremely restrictive, and we have to sort of try and find any hook that we can to do these kinds of things. So with Windows Phone 7, they really kind of force a page navigation model on you as part of the framework. And so we can't do a view model first approach there. We have to do a view first. So we have to kind of find hooks so that we can do the reverse view model lookup and apply the conventions at a different point in time. And we made it work, but it's a little bit uglier, and it's a little bit less consistent than I think the other techniques. So there are definitely some places that if I had my say, and I do give them an earful, but if I had my way, I guess there would be some changes that would allow us to do things a little bit cleaner and a little bit more powerfully.
So you briefly mentioned coroutines. Can you talk a little bit about what those are, how they're used?
Sure. One of the scenarios that happens or in rich client development is especially in Silverlight, is the need to call some sort of web service or something like this. You end up having to do lots of async programming. And this can get really, really nasty if you've got, say, a web service call that needs, you need to get the result from that, and then you need to call, say, another web service. And then you've got to do some other processing on a background thread. And so you get callbacks with callbacks with callbacks. Or if you're using lambdas, you get lambdas inside of lambdas inside of lambdas. And it gets kind of difficult to read and understand what the real program flow is. So what we did is we implemented, using iterators, a way to yield from a method a instance of a certain type of class, which we call iResult. And it has an execute method and a completed event. And what we do is we control the enumeration of the results of that method so that we never move to the next element until the completed event of the previous one is fired. Now, what this allows you to do is encapsulate your web service sort of call in an iResult instance and simply yield it. And then on the line of code following that yield, you can simply write code assuming that method executed synchronously almost. So it gives you a sequential execution or a sequential reading of your code, but an asynchronous execution of it. If you've seen the stuff they're working on for C# 5 with the asynchronous methods, it's very much the same kind of thing. The C# 5 features are the ideal, or much more closer to the ideal implementation of what we tried to do. This is basically we're doing sort of a hack on top of iterators to let us make simple asynchronous scenarios much easier to read and to manage. And it works pretty well. And this is one of the things we supply through actions. Because we control the invocation of that method, we can automatically supply the infrastructure to make the coroutine implementation work. So basically, anything you want to do asynchronously, if you want to write it in a sequential fashion and still have it work asynchronously, that's what coroutines lets you do. And most common scenarios are for web service calls. It was a big deal in Silverlight because there was no way to not call web service asynchronously. And that was really sort of the impetus for creating that feature. It happened out of frustration. So it almost happened on accident, just kind of playing around with what we could do. And it turned out to be very, very cool once I sort of realized what it was that sort of happened on accident. And there are some other frameworks that do this too. I think the Power Threading Library uses the same technique. There's a web server, I think it's Dream Server, maybe what it's called, that has you implement web services using coroutines. So it's not an original idea, but we implement it as part of the action mechanism so that you can execute these coroutines based off of any user interaction. Now, the interesting thing about our implementation, besides just being able to do asynchronous code easier, is that every instance of iResult gets passed something called an action execution context, which is basically a bunch of contextual information about the action that just fired. So for example, what UI element triggered this action to fire? What is the view that this element lives in? What is the view model that this method lives on, those sorts of things. And the result of this is that you can encapsulate inside of an iResult view-specific code. So you can almost think of it as a commanding implementation where you're sending commands back to the view. And you can do it from a view model in a way that keeps the view model completely decoupled from the view, because all you're doing is yielding an instance of this class. And then when it executes, it then goes and dynamically grabs any view-specific information and does things with it. So a neat example of this is, say, playing an animation. One of the problems with MVVM that people say, well, how do I deal with playing animations from a view model? Most of the time, it's a view-specific concern. It shouldn't be, you know, dealt with by a view model. That's another thing altogether. But let's just say that you have that scenario, and it really is based on your presentation logic and business logic or something like that. Well, you can actually implement a play animation result that literally you just simply yield it from your view model method, not knowing anything about the view or anything. And when it executes, it grabs the view, searches the resources of that view for an animation instance, and then plays it. So you can do all kinds of things, very, very interesting things using our particular coroutine implementation, such as play animations, showing modal dialogues, which in Silverlight have to show asynchronously. So that ties in there. Showing file dialogues, doing things like showing a busy indicator or setting focus to a control, but based off of a view model property rather than referencing the view directly. So it gives us an additional way to keep our views and our view models decoupled, but to sort of send interesting commands over to the view or to do various other asynchronous tasks besides web services. So that's coroutines in a nutshell. It's a little bit weird to get your head around at first. I find that when people realize what possibilities it opens up, they get pretty excited about it. And it definitely changes the way you handle a number of scenarios.
So we had some questions from Twitter. We had from Mabster, and he wanted to hear your opinion on the async CTP. And we also had one from Martin Doms, and he just asked how Caliburn will compare to the real coroutines in C# 5. So I think that's kind of the same question.
Basically, in a future version of Caliburn Micro, we're going to pretty much drastically change the way we do that, because C# 5's asynchronous method implementation is really what we were trying to get at with our simple coroutine implementation, but couldn't get there because the language didn't really support it. So, for example, C# 5, it's going to be much easier to compose asynchronous things together. It's going to be much easier to handle exceptions and do things like that. These things are a little bit more tricky with our implementation right now. So what we'll do is we will base our action implementation off of the tasks library and off of the new C# features. And our custom iterator will go away, and we'll have some new stuff. I need to do some research to figure out how I'm going to implement what I'm going to implement there. But we've got to find a way to pass the action execution context through. But other than that, you know, our implementation is going to go away because it's going to be, not as good as what the language will support at that time. So I'm looking forward to it. I haven't played with it yet myself, but I was really excited to see them do that. It's quite necessary, I think, in this. It's almost a little bit late, dare I say, in the language to add it, but I'm glad it's getting in there. Just the way things are going with server-side development, even on lots of other platforms with Node.js and other interesting things that are happening, it's really quite necessary that C# has a nice way of doing asynchronous programming without lots of callbacks. So it's definitely, I'm very excited about it, and I'm pleased with what I've seen, and we'll be adapting our implementation to take advantage of the new platform features.
One of the other features of the framework that you mentioned briefly was the window management screen conductor functionality, the role-based stuff. Can you talk a little bit more about how that all fits together?
Sure. The screens and conductors piece is probably the most difficult conceptually to understand. Actions, I think, they make sense. You click a button, you fire a method. Conventions, whether you like them or not, or know what the specific conventions are, the concept makes sense. Screens and conductors are a little bit more abstract at first because they deal really with the concept of, at least in our implementation, with thinking of your view model as a state machine, more or less, and modeling explicit state changes throughout your view models. So we have a class called a conductor, and we have a class called screen. There's a couple more classes, but let's just talk about these two. We have a scenario where, let's imagine a web browser, not a multi-tab modern web browser, but sort of your old school web browser where you're looking at a web page. And there are certain things that need to happen every time a new page loads, and there are certain things that need to happen every time that page unloads. So the browser is playing the role of conductor in that it is enforcing a life cycle for the page you're looking at. The page would be like a screen in our class. So really, it is a state machine where the conductor is the state machine and the various screens are the states that the machine can sort of be in at any one time. This scenario happens, if you start thinking about this, you'll see that a lot of UI you build has this all over the place. Web browser being a common one. If you expand that out to a multi-tab web browser, then each tab individual conductor, and also there's a conductor managing the collection of tabs as well, and knowing when you have switched from looking at one tab to looking at another tab. This is your typical MDI thing. If you think about Visual Studio and you've got a bunch of code files open and the toolbars are changing based off of whether you've got an XML document open or you've got a C# document open. Well, those toolbars are flipping in and out their icons based on what tab is active or which one is being deactivated. They're removing icons and so on and so forth. So there's a shell component somewhere in Visual Studio that's sort of playing some sort of conductor role, making sure that all the little screens sort of behave themselves, if you will, and follow an explicit set of state changes. So those are the roles that are kind of modeled by our classes. We have something that's we have a conductor class. We have a couple of different implementations of it that handles how it hangs on to screens and shuffles through them. And then we have a screen role. Now, one of the interesting things about the implementation is that they're treated like a composite pattern in Caliburn Micro. So every conductor is also a screen. So you can compose these things together to create rather complex UI. Again, going back to the browser scenario, you would have a conductor at the root level that had a bunch of screens in it, but each one of those screens itself, it had a bunch of tabs in it, but each one of those tabs itself would be a conductor. And inside of each one of those conductors would be a screen, which is the page that is currently being looked at in that particular tab. So you can imagine just putting these things together in a number of different ways and creating all kinds of different application shells. The common things are, you know, your web browser, your MDI, there's hybrid applications where you've got sort of navigating from different workspaces, but within that workspace, there's multiple tabs. Maybe one of those tabs itself, you know, is also navigating between things. So you can plug these together in like little Legos, if you will, to create all different kinds of shell experiences. It's really just it's really just a presentation tier specific implementation of the state pattern, more or less, tailored towards being data bindable and things like this. So if you were to implement this in Windows Forms, it would look entirely different. So our implementation is really geared around data binding and working with the type of composition I talked about with view composition earlier. So we start applying conventions over top of these models, binding views, and all of a sudden you just have a very interesting way of putting screens and conductors all together, and we just render the views composed against that, and all of a sudden you've got multiple tabs, pages inside of there, and everything is just sort of working, and the conductors are enforcing the life cycle. So that's it very briefly. It's one of those things I have written about a little bit and struggle with trying to explain. I think it's a conceptual leap. It's one of those things also that if you jump in trying to use it before you realize really what its real purpose is or what types of problems it's designed to solve, then you'll really confuse yourself. But it's one of those things that when you come up across a particular problem that it solves and you have that tool, it makes your life very, very easy, and it's very, very much an obvious and simple solution to it.
Now, Rob, actually, I wanted to say thank you for working on this framework, because I've used it in the past and it's been tremendously useful.
Oh, cool.
That's a beautiful piece of work, actually.
I'm glad you enjoy it. It's one of those things that, you know, talking about Caliburn versus Caliburn Micro, it's funny. Like, it's so simple in some ways, but it's taken several years of sort of like thinking and resolving the problem over and over again before that emerged. So I'm glad people are using it and that it's making people think about different ways to do things and getting rid of that tedious. For me, I have a pretty low tolerance for boilerplate code and for repetition. Mm-hmm. And early on, you know, the typical MVVM way is to create these delegate commands, and it's really just a bunch of stuff to sort of make the WPF or Silverlight framework work when you really just want to bind to a method directly. So I got frustrated with that pretty quick. So I had to solve that. And then we built so many shells that I started to see these conductor patterns emerging very generally. So, you know, you just sort of extract that and you start realizing that you're using conventions in your day-to-day work. Like, hey, I always call the customer view model and customer view. That's all. And looking at the web, people tend to follow some kind of pattern like that. Why don't we just put it in the framework and save ourselves having to like new up the view and then set the data context and then, you know, do all this other stuff. So cool. I know that I talked to you about it a little while back, but I didn't know that you'd had a chance to use it. So that's great.
Yeah, I've actually been doing a lot of Silverlight over the last 12 months.
Cool. What do you think? What do you think of Silverlight?
Well, you know, I still get frustrated with it sometimes. It feels a little fragile at times.
Yeah. Did you work with WPF at all prior?
I have, yes.
Yeah.
And I'd have to say I like WPF better.
Yeah, I understand the fragile in that context because there are a lot of things just work with WPF that when you went to do them in Silverlight, it would break down.
Right.
I think that's getting better. It's getting better with each release. But I'm doing a WPF project right now, and I hadn't actually done a WPF project in a little while. I've been doing mostly Silverlight stuff, and I forgot how easy certain things were. So you're used it, and Kevin, you've used it.
Yep, I'm using it right now.
Cool.
So this is obviously something you're working on. This is something Chris Benage is working on. We've had him on the show before. Do you have any other help, or is it the two of you guys working your butts off on this thing?
With Micro, we've got one other guy. His name is Marco Amendola, and he's been with me sort of like just about from the beginning with Caliburn, and he knows like both of these frameworks inside out and does some pretty interesting blogging and writes samples and does some cool stuff. But that's about it at the moment. I take a lot of patches now. We've got Micro using Mercurial, and that's awesome. I think people are just more likely to fork and fix something and then send a pull request. So that makes my life so much easier.
Yeah, I was curious about that. I've got some very simple tutorial projects going with Mercurial on CodePlex, and I wondered, I don't get any pull requests on them. I didn't really expect them. I just kind of put them out there. But I wondered for like a framework level thing that you're working on, you do get pull requests? You do get contributions that way?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I got them for Caliburn too. That was using Subversion. But I started seeing them earlier on in the project, and I started seeing a lot of people forking and even just playing around with things. But I've got quite a few contributions that way. That's quite nice. you know, it takes a significant amount of time to work on an open source project, even a small one. So when people who are using it contribute in any way, it's very well received, at least by me. So I think Mercurial has helped that a little bit for my project. So.
Yeah, cool. That's good to hear. I mean, there's the whole kind of like social Facebook-y side to GitHub, but I really feel like, you know, I wonder if like I enjoy using Mercurial I use Bitbucket, I use CodePlex, but you know, I wonder if that's going to take off at that kind of level that GitHub has. I hope it does.
I hope so too. I love it. I've used Git, Mercurial, Subversion. I've used just about everything, but I really like Mercurial. It works well. The CodePlex integration is nice. I think it's the default thing on CodePlex now, so hopefully that will encourage more people to use it, get more developers familiar with it. It's a little bit easier, I think. If you come from a Subversion background, it's a little bit easier to transition into Mercurial. So I think that is helpful when people are trying to figure out how to contribute, things like that. So I hope it takes off too.
Okay, so I think we have a first this time. We have our very first phoned-in question on our Twilio Power dial-in number. The question comes from Rick Rat on Twitter. And I'm not going to try to pronounce his last name if anybody else knows how to how to pronounce it.
I actually met the guy in Las Vegas, but I don't know how to pronounce his last name. But he's a cool guy. He's a fan of the show.
Anyway, so let's go ahead and listen to his question.
Hey, this is Rick Red. My question is, what can Caliburn do that, say, MDVM Lite doesn't do?
That's an excellent, excellent question. MDVM Lite is Yoram Bunyan's toolkit for doing MDVM application development across the same platforms, WPF, Silverlight, and Windows Phone 7. And can kind of think of it as sort of a bare minimum for doing MDVM. Base classes for view models, delegating commands, an event aggregation system, the kinds of stuff that you would probably write on every project. And so it's a simple kind of set of tools. It's different in that Caliburn and Caliburn Micro are a highly opinionated sort of way to compose your applications, whereas MVVM Lite is, like it says, just kind of a toolkit. It gives you the bare essentials that you need to follow the MVVM pattern. We go a little bit more sort of beyond that. We add the conventions, we add the conductors and things like that. So we add some more functionality and features and more opinions about how to put things together and how you should name your views and your view models and these sorts of things. It's a great toolkit. It's very, very popular. And if you haven't ever done any kind of MVVM before, or if you're new to Silverlight, it's probably a great place to start. I'm biased, obviously, but I think that once you build a couple of apps, you'll probably experience some of the frustrations that I did. And you might find yourself wanting to move into something more opinionated that can actually, via those opinions, do more work on your behalf. And that's really what Caliburn Micro does. It tries to do a little bit more work on your behalf, whereas MVVM Lite Toolkit gives you the bare pieces and, you know, and doesn't sort of, I don't know how to say, conscript you to to do things a certain way.
That makes total sense. It's like there's an introductory level, and then there's a more, once you're familiar with the framework, you want something to, like, you don't have to type the same stuff over and over and over again, and that's where an opinionated framework comes in, and that's what you've got. So, makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, Caliburn started out very much like the MVVM Lite Toolkit. You know, it started out with the same components, and then I sort of added on top and abstracted certain things away, and then started gradually putting more opinions in because I was just tired of writing code that I shouldn't have to write. So now, one thing I will say about the MVVM Lite Toolkit is that it really, really, really works great for shops that are very designer-centric. So if you've got a shop that leans heavily in that direction, that might be a greater place to start. You know, Yoram has that background, and he works a lot on very design-heavy projects, and so his toolkit was really geared to work exquisitely with Blend and from that kind of perspective of doing things. So that's another sort of a difference. I would say Caliburn Micro is maybe probably a little bit more favors the developer over the designer. Though, like I said earlier, everything works fine in Blend. So a little bit different of perspective or approaching the problem from a different angle.
So I think we've touched on the big areas of the framework. Is there anything else you think we've missed?
Let's see. You know, there are some other utility things, you know, that it does. I have a pub sub, simple in-process pub sub mechanism via the event aggregator. Very simple implementation. I found a lot of people tend to like it, though, and that's great for communication between disparate view models or keeping view models decoupled that need to somehow know about ambient events or things going on in the app. We have a window manager, which is just a simple little service that sort of gives you a view model first way of showing modal dialogues or pop-ups, things like this. So you hand it a view model, it finds the view, connects them together, applies all the conventions, then throws them in a you know, in a child window in Silverlight and pops it up, you know. So it sort of does all that glue stuff for you. Or in WPF, it pops it in a window and displays it as modal or whatever. So there's a couple little things like that. Those are pretty easy to, I think, understand once you look at them. I think we covered the major features. I guess I should say it's IOC friendly. You know, it doesn't really force you to use a container or any particular container, although since it favors sort of a compositional model of view models, it really works better with a container, but we don't make you use an inject or something like that, or MEF or whatever. Whatever container you don't like, we don't make you use it.
Yeah, that was one of those like first places where I look at this and I thought, hey, this is kind of different, because instead of doing the typical common service locator type of interface, you just have that class with where you replace function definitions, right?
Yeah, and, you know, because I went down the common service locator thing with the full version of Caliburn, and I ended up with this elaborate IOC abstraction and a pretty big configuration model for the framework, and it all works, and most users haven't really complained about it, but now I look at it, I just feel that it's big and complicated, and it's an unnecessary abstraction. So when I was working on Caliburn Micro, I said, what's like the minimal thing I can get away with here? And that's basically what I did for that.
Awesome.
Bit unorthodox, you know, but I don't know. It's just simple and it works, it seems to me.
Yeah, I like it.
Would you like to see that take off like in other frameworks? I mean, is that something you see that as a pattern that you see that other people could implement?
I don't know. I don't know about it. I feel like ask me that question in another year. And I'll have some better feedback from users about the problems that it caused them or whatnot. I mean, it's definitely not, I think it would throw people for a loop at first. But, I don't know. I like it. I'm happy with it. It works great for me and for my framework. I'm hesitant to recommend it to any framework developer because I don't really claim to know the full ramifications for it just yet. it's honestly a bit of an experiment. I think it's turning out nicely, but I don't know. I have enough information to say that I would love to see it take off.
That is one nice kind of thing that you can do with an open source framework, is that you can say, look, we're going to try this thing. This seems to work for us. We're the main, you know, we're building this primarily for us. So we're going to keep going with it, but, you know, let us know. And you kind of get to a place interactively where like a big framework like that Microsoft or some major corporation would release isn't going to get to that same place.
Right. Well, the other thing about it is, you know, like I said, I think I mentioned earlier, I initially implemented it for size reasons. If you're building a framework that lives on the server side, you know, you don't really have those things to care about. But I wanted some way of getting extensibility in the important parts of the framework as small and tiny as possible, because this thing was going to run on a phone, and for Silverlight, I wanted the download to be smaller. And I tried that out, and I looked at things when I compiled them and, you know, experimented a little bit. It definitely was significantly smaller. In fact, I didn't really keep any numbers on all this, but I was quite surprised what sometimes adding the simplest thing would do, and adding like a few K to a framework. You know, you just, by the time you add an interface and then a base implementation with virtual methods and this sort of thing, and then you gotta figure out, you've got to write some kind of code to either abstract the IOC container so that it can be easily configured, or you've got to write a configuration framework. All that just explodes. So juggling trade-offs, I favored small size with Caliburn Micro.
Any previews you can give us for what might be coming in Caliburn Micro 2.0?
Let's see, previews. The big one we already mentioned would be reworking the coroutines to basically just use the C# 5 stuff. We've got a few tweaks we might be working on around caching of views and things like that. Other than that, there's not a whole lot of ideas and nothing I want to really commit to. One, though, on a related note, can I give a plug? Is this a time to give plugs?
Absolutely.
This is officially now the Pimp Your Stuff segment of the show.
All right, cool. So last year, Mix did an open call And that's sort of how this thing was born in a way, Calibre Micro, based on a talk I did. So I submitted another talk with almost the same name this year. So last year I submitted Build Your Own MVVM Framework. And this year I submitted Build Your Own MVVM Framework with HTML and JavaScript. So I would love when voting opens up for people to carefully consider whether they might be interested in seeing something like Calibre Micro perhaps natively implemented in JavaScript. It's actually already mostly implemented, but if they would like to see it, I would love to have the opportunity to share that. So that's something fun I've been working on.
Rob, we need to have you give you a talk every mix. That seems to bring out some cool stuff out of you.
Well, I don't know. Lately, I've been excited by JavaScript because I realized that it's actually a pretty interesting little language, and I've been programming JavaScript all wrong. The community around JavaScript programming is really, really coming to its own in the last couple of years, and there are tons of enabling little frameworks out there, and I realized I liked, obviously I'm partial to and like the development workflow for Calibre Micro, and I realized that I could actually bring that sort of a workflow and thought process to building rich JavaScript apps without writing too much code, literally just sort of stringing together a lot of what's already out there, sort of the right pieces put together in the right way. So I'm playing around with that and just really enjoying it, and I'd love to share that. It's a framework I'm working on that's it's kind of like the framework is for the talk and the talk is for the framework, you know. And it's very prototypey, but it's fun stuff, and it's been very educational for me. So,
well, that actually sounds a lot like a question we got from Jeremy McCollum over Twitter, JEREMCC, and he asked, "Caliburn sounds similar to Knockout JS, but for Silverlight for Silverlight WPF." And Knockout JS is a framework, an MVVM framework that Steve Sanderson has been building.
Oh yeah, I know all about it. Actually, that's one of the things I'm kind of leveraging as an enabler. Yeah.
Cool. So it's the idea that what you're working on is leveraging that sort of thing and going to the opinionated level, or how is it different than what's in Knockout JS?
So I'm treating Knockout JS as sort of a platform data binding implementation, much the way that data binding is implemented in, you know, just as part of WPF and Silverlight. And I'm looking at layering on top of that data binding implementation all the sorts of stuff that I layered on top of it with Calibre Micro. So view location, composition, conventions, those sorts of things. So, I mean, the difference, there's a big difference, I think, between Knockout and Calibre Micro. And Calibre Micro is, like we've said, it's an opinionated framework. It does a lot more. Knockout is mostly centered around adding observables to objects, adding data binding against HTML. And it's got a few other sort of utility things that it does. It works with templating, and it has some stuff around JSON and things like that. So if you can imagine that as just a core data binding type-ish thing and then building some of the same opinions of Calibre Micro on top of that, that's something fun I've been working on and would hope to have the opportunity to share. If not, I'll find a way to share it some way, I'm sure. But I think that mix would be it. I would love to share that mix. You're going to ask me that question.
Kevin, do you want to?
Sure.
Want to?
I wouldn't want to put you in that position, John. So
I'd be happy to, but go ahead if you'd like to.
Rob, is Silverlight dead? We should have Scott Kuhn asking this question, but couldn't be with us tonight. He's sick.
Yeah, I figured he would be interested in the JavaScript stuff. But no, it's definitely not dead. It's far from dead. But, you know, there's a spectrum of scenarios that you are placed in where you need to build apps, right? And sometimes you Silverlight is just not an option for whatever you're building, but you want to build some sort of a rich Silverlight-like application. So For me, I don't want to throw out all the sort of mental models and patterns and practices that have worked for me. So I'm thinking about how to bring that to JavaScript. But you know, there's a continuum there between having a lot more platform access on Windows with WPF, you know, having full control, or Silverlight, where you've got you know, access to the file system cross-platform and some sort of platform support on Windows, hopefully maybe one day more on Mac. And then you sort of move down from there into JavaScript. If you had a Caliburn micro type framework in JavaScript, do a little bit more easily in terms of complex apps, I think. But you would be giving up some of the platform support that you would get from Silverlight. And then you sort of would move down there to like a typical web app, I guess, which would be state, you know, a stateless web app like you would build with MVC framework or something like that. So you have like, you have this whole spectrum, and you know, the stakeholders and so forth put you in various situations, and you have to pick the technology that can get it done the cheapest most of the time, and quickly and cheaply. And when sometimes that's Silverlight and sometimes it's not. But it fulfills a lot of scenarios, both JavaScript apps and Silverlight apps. And I'm actually pretty stoked about the next version of Silverlight with hardware accelerated 3D and multi-window support and cool things like that. I think, you know, the whole Silverlight is dead thing is funny, because I think it happened because Microsoft's marketing around Silverlight, in my opinion, has been kind of wrong since the beginning. They marketed it like it was for building websites, or they marketed it as a browser plugin, when they really should have marketed it as more of a cross-platform desktop app solution that had, you know, seamless and simple browser deploy, you know, like cross-platform click once type of a deal. And so I think in a sense that marketing perhaps added some confusion. Most of the Silverlight apps we build are basically desktop apps. And I've never once really thought of them as, not really thought of them as web apps. They're deployed through the browser. But other than that, they're desktop apps, really. So Silverlight is not dead. It's an awesome way to write rich desktop applications, in my opinion. I think most desktop apps on Windows should be written that way. Falling back to WPF when you just can't do it in Silverlight. But yeah, there's that continuum there, and there's a lot of scenarios that Silverlight is beautiful for.
I think that's just beautifully stated, because I've been kind of in this, you know, like I'm a fan of when you're working in the HTML world of being just pure semantic HTML, simple, light, you know, like delivering a document. Yep. But then this whole spectrum, like you're talking about, of this, you know, when you're moving to a place where HTML is not the right fit, Silverlight is a beautiful fit. Like, it's a great cross-platform, you know, desktop web solution that just does things that I mean, I've just been really happy with over the years, and bringing like the best parts of the .NET framework to just so many places. It's you know, just like I enjoy WPF, but it can be so heavy and so hard to just figure out what to do next. Whereas Silverlight, like the space that you're working in Silverlight is manageable. Mm-hmm. And it's a place where you can just get started and be productive quickly without just being like, you know, like, oh my God, I have to understand all this stuff. It's crazy. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. I was just actually reading some WPF docs the other day, learning some stuff I had no clue about. And I've been doing WPF since 2006 or 2005, somewhere in there.
Right.
So,
right,
yeah.
Right. I mean, WPF is like this brilliant framework, but it's like there's going to be things that no one will ever use 20 years after it's developed that are in there, you know? And it's like this beautifully designed, completely elegant framework that's over the heads of everyone because Einstein's dead, you know? Like, it's just, in some places, just too much, you know? And so Silverlight is this kind of lightweight, like, solves, you know, 99% of the cases you need to solve. And it's just like, it's just, and it's tiny and it's simple and it's easy to use. So yeah, that's my piece.
I agree.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show, Rob. It's great.
I had a good time.
Great, yeah. Discussion, and it's a great framework. So that's it for this show. Join us again next time on Herding Code.